Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gulos in the Bird? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
This is Michael Silverblatt. And you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking today to George Saunders. This is the second week that we're talking about his, I think, great novel, Lincoln in the Bardo. It really makes a bid to enter the ranks of American literature, by which I mean that it's trying to be as audacious as Whitman in speaking for everyone, as astounding as Melville in speaking across racial lines and the human-animal divide. And in this book, that divide is between life and death. But by the end of this book, we're hearing a vast chorus. We're in the Bardo, which is a place between the end of life and the beginning of the next life. According to the Tibetan Book of the Dead, there are, I think, six Bardo experiences. As the being, as the spirit progresses through its refining education. In this book, a child has died, Abraham Lincoln's child, Willie, and as we go through the book, the awareness that we've witnessed the death of the child, that the child is irreclaimable by life, that you don't move backwards, that you keep moving forwards, and that mourning is almost like rooting for the movement forward. And here we're being reminded of who we are mourning, of why we are mourning, and what we're mourning. These lines are most of them separate lines. They're spoken by individual characters in the Bardo, in the cemetery, which they refuse to regard as a cemetery. It's a sick house, because they think they're going to recover. They don't want to understand death, but now the universal understanding of death is occurring in this book, and a choral voice is entering. So it almost doesn't matter who is speaking. They're all speaking what they've learned by entering each other's spirits. This is toward the end of Lincoln in the Bardo. George Saunders is reading for us.
So these are two friends who are inhabiting Lincoln as he tries to make his final departure from the graveyard. His boy was gone. His boy was no more. His boy was nowhere. His boy was everywhere. There was nothing here for him now. His boy was no more here than any place else, that is. There was nothing special anymore about this place. His continued presence here was wrong, was wallowing. His having come here at all, a detour and a weakness. His mind was freshly inclined towards sorrow, toward the fact that the world was full of sorrow, that everyone labored under some burden of sorrow, that all were suffering, that whatever way one took in this world, one must try to remember that all were suffering, none content, all wronged, neglected, overlooked, misunderstood. Therefore, one must do what one could to lighten the load of those with whom one came into contact. That his current state of sorrow was not uniquely his, not at all, but rather its like would yet be felt by scores of others in all times, in every time, and must not be prolonged or exaggerated, because in this state he could be of no help to anyone. And given that his position in the world situated him to be either of great help or great harm, it would not do to stay low, if he could help it. All were in sorrow, or had been, or soon would be. It was the nature of things. Though on the surface it seemed every person was different, this was not true. At the core of each lay suffering, our eventual end, the many losses we must experience on the way to that end. We must try to see one another in this way, as suffering, limited beings, perennially outmatched by circumstance, inadequately endowed with compensatory graces. His sympathy extended to all in this instant, blundering in its strict logic across all divides. He was leaving here broken, awed, humbled, diminished, ready to believe anything of this world, made less rigidly himself through this loss, therefore quite powerful, reduced, ruined, remade, merciful, patient, dazzled. And yet...
George Saunders reading from one of the final chapters in the last 30 pages of Lincoln in the Bardo. Now, these are the rhythms of prayer, yes? And it seems to me that by and large, they're not the rhythms of fiction writing. You're asking the reader to participate in a ceremony, it seems to me. The ceremony of surrender, and the ceremony that says that when you're made broken through loss, you're therefore quite powerful, that as you are reduced and ruined, you're remade. Broken, awed, humbled, and diminished. It seems like words, in the definitions that we know, are not enough anymore to describe these states, that these pile-ups of adjectives are a spectrum, like a rainbow of possible and possibly contradictory feelings. I don't know of any book that makes me wonder whether the writer was feeling enormous fear at going this far in the direction of post-language and spiritual address.
Well, yes, but also by that time you're emboldened. You know, you're on the task, and it doesn't really matter that much if it's a failure. You know, one of the things that I'll cherish about our friendship and about this long conversation we've had is that from the first time I walked in here in 96, I think it was, 97, I felt a kindred spirit who felt the same way about books I do, which is that it's not just books, you know, that the purpose of literature is not just to be clever or ornamental or even merely conceptual, intellectual, but that we're reading them to try to, experience life, to try to maybe not even have answers, but pose the right questions, and that is really high-level stuff. So to me, that when I got to this part in the book, the last 30 pages, crazy things were happening in my mind, and, you know, it wasn't very doubtful, because at that point, it's kind of like if you jump off the cliff, should you fall? You know, it felt that way. And
there's no more choice.
There's no more choice.
You're doing what the book has given you to do.
Right. And at that point, the only thing you're worried about is that your conventional mind and the long habits of writing you've made will mess you up. That's what I was scared of. So I was trying to get out of my own way, because, you know, this is probably not a truthful metaphor, but I feel like it's a useful one. I always call it the subconscious. That's probably not the right usage. But there's something over here that is not me that is working. And it's been working since 96 or before. It's over there on the side. It's a great intuitive source of something, knowledge. The job is to get that to the table and get my stupid self out of the way. And that was really happening in those last 30 pages, so I just didn't want to bobble it, you know.
I'm talking to George Saunders about the extraordinary risks inherent in writing a novel about death and the remaking of the human spirit. By this point in the book, the point we've just heard, the people in the cemetery where Willie has been buried, where Lincoln has been visiting and taking Willie out of his coffin and holding him in his arms, the people have interfused, are entering one another's bodies and consciousnesses, and they are convincing each other to let go of this refusal to leave the sick room, to leave the moment after life and enter whatever comes next. But Willie is the one who understands first that it's time for him to go, that his father, Abraham Lincoln, should not have been there, that he, Willie, should not have been reliant upon that amount of consolation, that moving forward is all that there is to do, that there is no choice, and he calls them all. He becomes the great orator. He becomes the Lincoln among this crowd, and he calls them to enter the next world following him, and gradually they do.
As I was writing this, I kept thinking about that line. I think it's from the Gnostic Gospels, you know, if you bring forth that which is within you, it will save you. If you fail to bring forth that which is within you, it will destroy you. And that, I mean, certainly it's true in this little afterlife world, but it's also true now, you know. And one of the things in the Tibetan tradition you pick up is that whatever there is of the afterlife, it can't be different from now. It's continuous mind. So whatever habits of thought we have now, they continue. So the book, any book about the afterlife, kind of course, becomes about right this instant as well. You know, how good are we at accepting our actual condition right now? How much are we in the thrall of delusional, habitual ideas about our own permanence and our own importance and so on, you know? But.
Now, you tell me you were a fairly serious Catholic, mm-hmm. and now you're a striving Buddhist. Tell me the language, the rhythms of those prayers. Are they similar?
I expect so, yeah. I mean, I was a reader when I was a kid, so one of the first big public thrills was to go up with the biblical text and you get to read it on a microphone in front of your classmates. And I remember that, you know, you can feel the rhythms in those beautiful texts. So I expect so. And maybe, you know, something you said earlier was really interesting to me. There was a point in this book where I found myself shedding certain intellectual clothing that I'd been putting on for a long time. And I think it has to do with what's literary and what's not. So I can see in earlier books, there's a certain tendency to hide behind I don't know how to describe it, the comic, but also even the rhythmic. There's a certain contemporary rhythm that I take a lot of comfort in. Well, on a surface level, I'm supposed to at least pretend to be doing 19th century diction, which at first felt like a constraint, and then it felt like a liberation. So these rhythms you're talking about were there for me, but I can't say that I've used them before, partly because I'd self-prohibited for some complicated psychological reasons. So it was quite wonderful to go, yeah, of course I can. I can do that which I might have previously considered too lyrical.
Much of our great American writing comes from the diction of Scripture. Mm-hmm. That whether that's Emily Dickinson poems or, well, the Puritan sermons themselves, Whitman, Melville, Hawthorne,
Kerouac.
Kerouac, Ginsberg, exactly. That incantation is intrinsic to our literature, what I think you've risked, many, many readers regard you as their profanely comic writer. You are a writer who really invents outrageous circumstances. And here, it's the most outrageous circumstance at all, in a sense. The march between life and death, and between death and what comes after death. What could be more invented than that which we cannot know? The other stuff is strategy and working out the consequences. But here you really did let go of what you knew would happen. Did you know where this book would end?
No, no. I just, honestly, I got to the point where I just felt like I have got to risk this or I'm going to be caught in a cycle of, you know, repetition. Or actually, to be more honest, this is what interests me so much, you know. And so, these questions that put forth, they sometimes seem a little corny, but what are we doing here? How are we supposed to live now so as to make our death less terrible? Those things, we have to think about them. And I think sometimes what we call style or even the things for which we become known can be real traps. You know, you're afraid to venture out beyond those.
If the transformations being made here, although spiritual, last with you as a reader as a new infusion of morality or the sacredness of death or the sacredness of birth or even, dare I say it, the sacredness of children, Well, you know, that is a subject. It isn't automatically corny.
Well, also, I found myself thinking about the sacredness of form, you know, and the fact that when we talk about a work of art, I think in our time there's a tendency to talk about it in terms of theme, what's the takeaway. But as real readers know, that that's a byproduct. But the way you actually achieve that is through some kind of, I mean, sometimes it's just the way one line sits against another, the way a page physically looks. So for me, a lot of it was concentrating on those things, and those things are not good sports. If you honor a certain formal convention, the formal convention will sit you down and say, now, therefore, since you did A, you must do B, no matter where it takes you. And so a lot of the stuff we're talking about here was, I think certainly it's a result of a spiritual involvement on my part, but it's as much a part of formal involvement in the book. The book says, do this. You say, okay, I have to do it, or else I'm becoming disappointing, you know.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW, and I'm talking with George Saunders about his book, Lincoln in the Bardo. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with George Saunders about his novel, Lincoln in the Bardo. It's his first novel. And what we're discussing here is it possible that what the book might lose in the nature of comedy, that it gains in the nature of beauty, and that somehow comedy is at war with profundity, and furthermore, that people who love comedy are sometimes at war against profundity? Now, I'd say that this book is an attempt to bring your readers, because there are hilarious things here. There are unnaturally large erections. There are the argument of, yes, always funny. There's plenty of comedy. but it's not the soul of the book. And the book has a soul that's literally a soul.
Well, I think, in a way, what I found myself thinking when I was writing this was that maybe we do ourselves a disservice by the labeling. They're kind of co-enabling things. So in other words, since very somber circumstances exist literally side by side with farts, you know, whatever, then those things, if we destabilize them by taking the labels off them, they can be in a better relationship. Or another way of saying it is, I think, I mean, on a practical level, you're always giving a little bit of this and taking away, like riding a bike. You're trying to keep the story moving ahead. If it becomes too tragic, the part of us that knows life is also largely comic gets discontent, and vice versa, you know.
I felt a great release from the obligation to mechanical and well-contrived
yes.
comedy.
So did I as a writer. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I really felt you doing something you hadn't done before, and you remember that old word, hornswoggled? I was going to be hornswoggled if it could work. I was full of doubt. Hmm. And another old phrase, lo and behold.
Lo and behold, you weren't hornswoggled.
Well, there was yeah. great beauty and an impulse to tears in the silences. These are pages that have a lot of blank space on them between the dialogue of the different people. And I think the blank space is the space of grief and the space of mourning and the space for catching one's breath and feeling what this author is asking you to do. I think that this book about the beginning of the Civil War is also about the beginning of another Civil War. That the book is asking us to contemplate the division in our country then and now, and that that division is not only a political division, it's a spiritual division.
I hope you're right. I mean, it certainly feels that way to me. I mean, that's the goal. I think that would be the goal of any work of art, is that if you could drop it on a time that was difficult, it would remind us that the short-term temporal divisions are somehow delusional, even though we might not be able to feel how they're delusional at the moment.
Here in this book, Lincoln is being sent out of the cemetery with the different parts of his spirit filled with the appreciation of what it means to understand another person. I mean, that's such a difficult thing to accomplish, even with Lincoln, you know?
You know, one of the things that, as you're speaking, I'm realizing that for me, what's happened over the years of my writing career is that I've come to have a higher opinion of my reader. One, just from meeting a lot of them, but also from having taken chances and having people rise to that. So I think that these moments there are sometimes a moment of empathy between two characters. Well, that results from the writer thinking well of the characters and writing them up, so to speak. But what's happened for me in the last X number of years is I go, oh, yeah, of course, the reader is in on that too. So I need to look at the reader and say, what can she bear? And what's changed for me over the years is, if I could sort of cartoon it, early on, it was more of my attitude is let me impress her, let me dazzle her. And now it's more let me include her. So let me understand my reader as someone who is every bit as terrified of death and celebratory of life as I am, and then write to that person, assuming that if it means to me, it means to her. And there were places in this book where that was a clear crossroads, you know. I had to either continue to really hold my reader in high regard and take a chance with her or chicken out, basically.
Is this a new beginning? Will you do a novel again? How do you feel about long-form writing as opposed to the shorter stories?
Well, I love doing it, but I know myself well enough to say I'm going to go right back to stories. This one, I didn't plan it to be a novel. I just looked, I was constantly had an eye on it, like, please don't blow it up. You know, I don't want to surrender efficiency and speed. So I think just as a discipline, I'm going to go back when I'm done with this and just start another story. And, you know, I would love for this to happen again, but it didn't happen again because I tried it. It happened again because it sort of insisted.
Hmm. Very interesting. Do you think, write stories that are different because you've written this novel?
For sure. I hope so, because, you know, there's always that bit of insecurity that says, here's what you do. Here's what you've done. Here's what you should. And that is a trap, you know. And so I'm hoping to, you know, the idea is that you put an obstacle in your way, you know, which is the book you're trying to write. It comes up into your body and mind, and then you're not the same person next. So, yeah, I hope so.
The book that he wrote is called Lincoln in the Bardo. It's about Lincoln's experience of the death of his beloved son, Willie, and his following the body of Willie into the cemetery where a whole population of bodies have refused to move on to the next life because they're being held in place by love. Surrendering love in order to move on is a fascinating subject. And also a dark one. I'm very happy to have spoken to George Saunders, whose book is published by Random House. Thank you for joining me.
Michael, thank you. And sincerely, you know, I've been coming in here and I've never once not been changed. And whenever I'm writing, I've got you in my mind and my heart. So thank you so much.
That's a great honor. And thank you for saying so. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Lincoln in the Bardo at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
A bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. And we're just reading this. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Stay tuned. The world is coming up next.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.